The case was dormant for a couple of years, even though investigations were going on. They were following the money. As the gold certificates were showing up all along the eastern seaboard, they tried to trace the money. And despite Lindbergh's objection, the police had allowed bank officials to record the serial numbers of the bills, so when they showed up in different places, they know where the money came from. On September 17, 1934, a Lindbergh ransom bill was passed at a gas station in the Bronx. And since it was a gold certificate, which were being recalled by the government during the Great Gold Heist, the attendant wrote down the license number so he wouldn't get stuck for the 10 bucks, because he had to turn that in. It was confirmed on the bank's list and traced back to Bruno Richard Hauptmann, who was arrested the next day. New York police would find about $15,000 of the ransom money in Hauptmann's garage. He claimed to be holding it for his business partner, Isidore Frisch, who had left for Germany, paid for his ticket with Lindbergh ransom money, and eventually died there. It was a fishy story, but turns out it seemed to be more true than the official story. But of course, the headlines of all the papers convicted Hauptmann before he even got to the stand to defend himself. The money was found wrapped in newspapers from September 1934 and not from April 1932 when the ransom drop went down. This definitely supported Hauptmann's story that he had recently rediscovered the package the now deceased Frisch had left in his care before sailing back to Germany. He was astounded to find it contained money since Frisch had owed him $7,000, but was beyond repaying it. Hauptmann hid it in the garage and didn't tell his wife about it. If a guy owes you $7,000 and you've stashed $15,000 of his money, well, it would make sense that you would take the money back that he owed you and leave the rest or a portion of it for him. Hauptmann's wife did alibi him for the murder. Several witnesses could place Hauptmann 2 hours away from Hopewell on the night in question. He picked her up at a Bronx bakery where she worked. Anna Hauptmann insisted that her husband picked her up every Tuesday night, including March 1st, 1932. And Hauptmann's work records show him doing carpentry work in New York City that day. Beyond the ransom money, the case against Hauptmann was thin. Hauptmann was happily married with a young son, had many friends among the Bronx German community, including Isidore Frisch. And he was a bit secretive. He was an illegal immigrant, and his wife didn't even know his first name was Bruno until he was arrested. At trial, the New Jersey prosecutor pressed on full ahead. Someone had to pay for the killing of the Lindbergh baby. Handwriting experts claim Hauptmann wrote the 14 ransom notes, while agreeing the one in the nursery was different from the others. Two unsavory and unreliable witnesses placed him near Highfields the day of the crime. All the other witnesses placed him in the Bronx. Convoluted, quote, wood evidence supposedly provided that master carpenter Hauptmann had pulled a single board out of his landlord's attic to finish the kidnap lather rather than just use the wood stored in his garage. Unrealistic and unnecessary work going into a handmade ladder. Doesn't sound feasible. And of course, there was the money, the ransom money, even though most of it was still unaccounted for. It was the testimony by Condon and Lindbergh which won the case. Though neither man before had identified him as the guy in the cemetery, or as they called him, Cemetery John, the rose was somehow pinned on him as being that guy. Think about this. Lindbergh's testimony, highly improbable. He identified a voice he heard calling to Condon from over 70 yards away and 3 years earlier as that of being Bruno Richard Hauptmann. Highly unlikely. But that turned out to be all the jury needed to convict him. Even with the conviction, the logistics of the crime was just a mystery. How could Hauptmann have accomplished the incredible scheme all by himself? Up until the point of Hauptmann's arrest, it was thought that it was a well-organized gang which had been planning the abduction for some time. How could it only be one man at this point one man to pull off this amazing feat. And when the death sentence was handed down, the Boston Herald put it right up on the line. They said, Houtman's trial was a raucous tragedy. With few exceptions, prosecution witnesses either distorted the truth or committed flat-out perjury. The state police had tampered with physical evidence and, in many cases, suppressed vital information. Does this sound how we would conduct a trial? Such a high-profile case. And even more amazing than that, Lindbergh himself was allowed to sit at the prosecutor's table for the whole trial, and he was wearing a shoulder holster under his suit. From a legal perspective, having the victim's father in the courtroom for any reason other than his own testimony is strictly forbidden and grounds for an appeal.